We're going to change gears and reimagine extinct organisms in an innovative way. I ask you to give a warm welcome to Joshua Knuppe, paleo artist.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for coming to my talk. It's the first time I'm in front of such a big crowd, so I'm a little bit nervous. Also, big shout out to the person who came in an inflatable T-Rex costume. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The meme lives on. Yes. So now something completely different after talking about digital wallets and stuff. Dinosaurs. Why, you will maybe understand later. But yes, let us begin. So dinosaurs, right? I'm saying this name and the images that pop up in your head are probably these. All good and right. However, the question is like, why do we see these images and don't have this in our head when the word dinosaur pops up? And I picked here the creme de la creme already. Usually, dinosaur fossils aren't this pretty. And to answer this question very quickly, it's because of stupid people like us. Paleo artists. Paleo art is a nearly over 200-year-old tradition at this point. This year we celebrated actually 200 years of the name dinosaurs. And yes, we are specialized in bringing the past back to life in artistic ways. How we do that, to borrow from Dungeons and Dragons, some might compare us to wizards. We study and read a lot, and then the magic happens. Others might say, oh, we are more like necromancers. We bring the dead back from the life, back to life. Also, I mean, I'm okay with that, but at the end of the day, no, we are actually stage magicians. We create illusions. And I may mean that in the most positive way possible. It sounds first like, it's not real and stuff like that. And I don't mean it just like René Magritte meant it with his famous painting, This Is Not a Pipe, in which he points out, yes, this painting is a painting and not the object it depicts. I mean it also in the way that we create illusions of certainty. We create images that make you believe this is how they looked. And this has several implications. For one, it gives us a certain amount of power over how people imagine the past. And I'm talking about millions and millions of years. Human history is a speck on the landscape in compared to that. But only a little bit of our immense power actually reaches the public because society in its incredible wisdom has decided to filter our work, no matter how much we produce, through several layers until it trickles down on your day-to-day Twitter feed, which means that whatever the media reproduces, stuff like that, whatever franchises picks up, whatever ends up in popular books and stuff, usually is the most conservative takes you will see. Which results in dinosaurs in popular media being oftentimes very bland, unimaginative. They usually, with big franchises, are canonized. You have a certain way an animal has to look like. I have a double 30 in there for some reason. But the science of this depiction also is oftentimes like 30 to 20 years behind. There are things that only just now, that were already common knowledge for people like me in the 90s, begin to pop up in popular depictions of these animals. Which of course begs the question, Oh yeah, here. This is a good example of why how much popular perception lags behind. This is just all the dinosaur species discovered this year, and it's getting more every year. We are living in a golden age of paleontology and paleo art, but if you look at popular books and big budget blockbusters that are produced, you wouldn't really get that. The question, of course, is, does it need to be this way? No. And there are several things that we can do to change that. And one thing is doing talks like this to change people's perception of how we work, because most of you guys will have seen our work, but the process behind it and who the people are behind these artworks is usually not shown. Yes, there are scientists on TV and stuff like that and so on, but what every kid is looking at, the big, cool image that comes with a press release, nobody's talking about who made that and how it was made. So I will give here a personal and very recent example. This is Alpkarakush. It's a large meat-eating dinosaur from Kyrgyzstan in Asia. Was published this year. And you see here all the materials they have. This is two specimens that were put together, like a subadult specimen and an adult one, potentially a family. Who knows? Could be mother and son or something like that. But there already the speculation begins. And this is all the material I had to work with when I created artwork for the press release. This is already a really nice specimen, by the way. Oftentimes I have much shittier stuff to work with. So what I usually first do is I go in and try to make sense of the bones we have, which usually often involves looking at close related specimens, species, in this case Cynraptor, also from Asia, which we have several nearly complete specimens for, so really, really good to compare it to, so I can see like where differentiated is in terms of proportions and stuff like that, also like what oddities might pop up in these comparisons. So I'm looking at tons of skeletal material and take the publications that I usually get before it's published and scale all these elements into skeletal drawings that colleagues have already created for these relatives. And you can already see like this is like a screenshot of basically my canvas when I start working on this. I already start like sketching out little ideas and stuff like that. Goes there, thank you. To get a feel for what you could do with these things. Also already little spoilers down there, things I want to do with the softer parts. Then it comes to like, okay, we have a skeleton now, more or less. We have to wrap it in muscles. And then again, I'm looking at the literature, look at related taxa where we see, okay, this has been published on this. And this is also something that changes all the time. Paleontology is an extremely short, considering we are working with animals that are dead for so many million years, it's changing rapidly. There are publications coming out daily. I'm not exaggerating. I have a Discord group with a channel just for paleo news, and I'm getting notifications every few hours. Muscles are some of these things that constantly getting reevaluated, so you constantly have to be on top of your game. And for example, T-Rex famously in Jurassic Park has a razor slim tail, but a few years back colleagues looked at modern reptiles and at T-Rex and determined, wait, these old reconstructions, they couldn't walk. Because one of the major muscles, the caudofemoralis longus, this big red thing down there was missing, which makes not just like makes them possible for the leg to move back, but it also makes the tail a lot thicker than it was usually depicted until then. Then something that is really talked about, fat. We usually think of fat like something that mammals have, especially us. but also cows, pigs, and stuff like that. But reptiles have it too. And especially in captivity, as you can see with this beautiful Nile crocodile here, it can get pretty extensive. And the animals in Jurassic Park, for example, are all living in captivity. They have little exercise and lots of high-quality food. We should expect them to be so much more chunky. Well, fat shaming is the thing everywhere. And then we move, of course, to the skin. We have a lot of dinosaur skin at this point. We have all sorts of different scale types and shapes and sizes, sometimes complete mummies, for example, of down here, that's a hadrosaur, a duck-billed dinosaur. We have a lot of material for these guys. When you are in Frankfurt, maybe at the Senckenberg Museum, you can see a complete specimen full of that. But as it turned out, especially during the 90s, this is only half the story, because exceptional preserved specimens, especially from China, showed that we are missing a big chunk of what makes up the look of dinosaurs, and that's feathers. Quite a few of you might already know that, but modern day birds are dinosaurs. You can't just put in, like, here does the dinosaur end, and here does the bird start. It's such a fluent transition that is so well understood that you can fill several textbooks with that at this point. And the preservation does not only go into like the little meat-eating dinosaurs like Velociraptor and stuff, for which we actually have preservation that shows that they also had feathers. But even larger ones, and even some of the plant eaters, like the Psittacosaurus over there. Oh, that's a microphone. I'm just holding it now. Where you can see so many details, like bristles along the tail, but also details like the wool cloaca being preserved. And every little scale, beautiful specimens, unfortunately acquired by Frankfurt through the black market. But that's something for a different talk. So we are getting a lot of information here, and you can see in this very simplified cladogram how these diagrams are called, how you can draw a direct line from the base of dinosaurs down there to birds. And that's why we paleoartists constantly have to question ourselves how much scales, how many feathers, stuff like that. Even in large animals, we have a tyrannosaur from China, 9 meters long, completely covered in feathers. So you can't just say, oh, it's larger than an elephant, so I just make it naked. But back to Alp Karakush. There are so many things we don't know about this animal. And there are so many things that never preserve. These things from China, they are exceptional. And even in these few instances, we see a wide variety of structures we would have never expected. And this is something we see in many modern day animals as well, which is why we paleoartists often look at modern day animals to find inspiration, what we could do with our creatures. Like things like the dewlaps on many lizards, the feathery crests on many birds, all these things leave no trace behind in the bones. So we can play with that. So we first try to reduce basically the randomness, and what is then left in the gaps in the fossil record, then we can get creative. And that is something that way too few people realize and do. Here, for example, something that was very important to us with Alp Karakush was the eyebrows. That is one of the few skull bones that have been preserved, and it's weirdly knobby, very rugose, and like sticking out of the face in a way. But these kinds of structures don't usually come like that in life. There is something on top, usually keratin, so a horny covering. And the question was, go we with a like rhino-like shape, where it's like very smooth? Do we go more like with something that some lizards have, where it's very, very rugose, very small, tubercle-like scales? Or do we maybe mix it up with some larger, nearly horn-like scales in between? Then we can go on, you already see it here a little bit, how much feathers do we want to give it? It could be even crazier. The scales, too. We don't know how the scales of this animal look like, and they could be in all sorts of shapes and sizes. So here we also have to take creative steps to come to a pleasing solution. And then the wild stuff begins, the very fleshy bits that never basically preserve, but could be there, like dewlaps and wattles and stuff like that, could all have been on the animal. On top of that, because of the close relationship to birds, dinosaurs had very bird-like lungs and air sac systems, which means they had sacs of air that were connected to the lungs throughout the whole skeleton and under the skin even. And in modern day birds, these can be inflatable. Like, going back a little bit here, in the frigate bird here below the crested bird there, that is an air sac that is inflated. That is an extreme case, but it could be also something we see in dinosaurs. And then of course, the endless debate about color. We have a lot of wiggle room here to play around, and the topic of color alone would warrant an own talk probably, but we don't have time for that. Just saying, in most cases we don't know, but in a few cases, in recent years, there have been, thanks to some new imaging technology, remarkable studies that have looked especially at fossils from China, that show so-called melanosomes. These are tiny bodies within the cells in which pigments are stored. And based on their distribution and shape, we can determine colors to a certain degree. Like this Microraptor here, for example, turned out to be dark blue iridescent, something we would have never expected. But these are still far very, very rare and far between. Okay, a last thing that we usually take into account when reconstructing these animals is like what else lived with it and what was the environment like. When I look at a paper looking for like an animal to reconstruct, the first thing where I look is its environment. Because although we like to imagine the Mesozoic, the time of the dinosaurs, as this lush tropical paradise, it was way, way more diverse than we give it credit, down to snow and glaciers in mountains and at the poles, where we also find dinosaurs. But here's the kicker. The really interesting stuff starts when we look at behavior, because pop culture gives us such a beautiful amount of stereotypes and tropes that we can break. A famous example here is like dinosaurs in movies always roaring at the camera or some imaginary rival somewhere. No animal does that. Why would they? They would just alert the T-Rex from the other territory to come over. Oh, you have food there, I heard. Makes no sense. Also, like, what do you want to intimidate? Like, there's nothing around. There's no reason to give this victorious roar. It always feels a little bit silly, at least to me. So there's a lot of behaviors we can actually, again, draw from modern-day animals. Like, caring for the next generation, however that may look like. Looking just at the next relatives of dinosaurs, modern-day birds, which are dinosaurs, and crocodilians, which are also in the group called archosaurs, which is a large group that includes dinosaurs, birds, and some other stuff, there is usually parental care going on, so you can play with that, because parental care can come in all sorts of ways. We have cleaning and relaxing. A T-Rex might be the largest predator of its ecosystem, but like a lion, it would probably sleep a lot. you will not have a T-Rex be on the prowl 24/7. Instead, you would probably come across it because you heard it snoring. Play behavior, even animals that we do not expect it from, play. It sometimes doesn't look like that because they don't have facial muscles to show that they are delighted, but there are no other explanations for some of these behaviors other than they have fun. It's famously known for mammals, birds, but also quite a few reptiles. Then we have display behavior, like showing off to other conspecifics of your species. And of course, that also leads into mating behavior, which is usually overlooked. I don't know why, but I have a lot of fun depicting mating behavior in dinosaurs. There are beautiful debates in our community about how they did it, which is sometimes really hard to imagine when you have something like Stegosaurus or Ankylosaurus with all these bony plates and spines everywhere. I prefer the zipper maneuver when you come from... Anyway. And this can lead to interesting images too, like thinking about how they defended themselves. We have in South America, for example, several places where we find relatively small is still 8 meters, long-necked dinosaurs together with enormous meat eaters, theropods. So how did they not become dinner? Because yes, a tail is there, but at that size, it only tickles the T-Rex. So one idea that I came, for example, up is that they had in their necks glands, which they produce a foul-smelling liquid from that they spray upon their predator. We have no evidence for this whatsoever, but there are so many animals today that do it, independently evolved from each other. Dinosaurs just being silly and relaxing and cleaning, like this Carcharodontosaur here having a lovely little mud bath and unfortunately disturbing a little turtle in the process. Keratin. We have all these horned dinosaurs where we have beautifully preserved frills and horn cores and everything, but looking at modern day animals, you will realize at some point, wait, the horn in some goats is actually like 60% longer than the bone underneath. What could that mean for Triceratops? Well, there are funny ideas floating around. Play behavior, totally a thing. I obscured the cloaca here just for this talk. And the environment plays into it too. Environments can do so much for an image. This is, for example, Demandosaurus from Spain, and there was a recent paper that showed there might have been a cold snap during the early Cretaceous that caused glaciers to form in Spain during that time. A wild thing to speculate about how that might have looked like. And then we have interactions. We talked now about single species, single animals, but what they could like done to each other can add even more interesting depth to an image and widen the horizon, you might say. Or things that you would not expect, because animals do not always behave like we think they should. Maybe some of you have seen videos of cows going over a meadow, finding a few little ducklings walking along there and being like Pac-Man, because, well, there's lots of nutrients to get in there. So a little duckling is, even for a cow that is usually known as a plant eater, just a little snack. And in this case, it's a Diplodocus going after the chicks of an Allosaurus that have just hatched. Also, when it comes to diets, the other way around it works too. Like many predators today occasionally eat plants for their digestive system. And some animals do things you would not expect looking at their bones, like grizzly bears eat a lot of salmon. When you look at their skulls, nothing speaks for them having an adaptation to eat salmon, and yet they eat tons of it. Stuff like that could have been true for Mesozoic dinosaurs as well. So there are several layers to that, which we can use, like layers of speculation, to arrive at much more interesting images than we are used to. First, we are looking at the skeletons, and even there we can already start to speculate, because what animal you choose, for example, to patch up these the gaps in the fossil record, that is already a creative decision. Soft tissue and color does a lot. Then you have the behavior on top, the interactions between different animals, the landscape that you choose, which even if you find an animal in a certain environment, it doesn't mean it lived there necessarily, it's just that it's preserved there. Because, well, a river was flowing there, and that's where 99% of land animals are preserved. Because you have to, you need sediment to pile up. And when a corpse falls into that, it could have lived along the whole length of the river or just where we find it. And perspectives. Usually, dinosaurs are depicted in extremely boring perspectives. At least, that is my opinion. In this case, for example, down here, I show a newly described large sauropod from the Pyrenees laying its eggs, and the cameraman is just below its tail, looking up, caught in the act, basically. That is something you will rarely see in pop media. And this can even get more extreme here. We have an Apatosaurus doing a little playful dust bath in during the late Jurassic. Really bizarre stuff can happen when you play with feathers, for example, where these Falcarias, which are basal pterosaurs, oh, this goes too far. Anyway, these guys, I gave them a lot of feathers on their necks. And the male here, or maybe it's a female, sometimes it's weird, like pushes up its feathers to appear larger and more intimidating to a potential mate, which accidentally makes it look a little bit like a Christmas tree. Then weird stuff, again, that you wouldn't expect, like bone hoarding. These armored dinosaurs, well, they need to build their armor somehow. Well, how do they do that? Looking at modern-day animals, you realize many, many animals with lots of weird ornaments eat bone. Even the big plant eaters like giraffes and stuff. There are images online where giraffes pick up the skeleton of a wildebeest and fling it through the air just to get to the juicy, calcium-rich bits in there. And this is something that we could also expect from these big herbivores. And this, of course, not only is something we can apply to dinosaurs, because there's a whole host of other animals that are oftentimes neglected in popular media, especially pterosaurs, are so bizarre. And we only ever get to see like 1 to 3 species. They, like dinosaurs, had air sac systems. And oh boy, what could they do with it? I try to speculate a little bit here. But of course, this all brings us to the question, why should we care? Why is this important? I mean, for me, it's important because it's my job and I really love these animals. But yeah, why? Well, it's paleontology is one of these rare cases. It's a science. It does not produce food. It doesn't bring us new medicine, no new weapons, no new technology that we can play with, stuff like that. So why should we care? And many paleontologists and scholars have mused about this question for a long time. We have still no answer, really. But there are a few ideas floating around. For one, it's just more interesting to play with these ideas. And in the end of the day, it's also a more honest approach to science outreach, because you can't explain every time that, oh yeah, we only have these few bones, we could all do all that, blah, 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 blah with it. You can just show that and not fall into these canon depictions and conformities we like to fall into. And that, of course, challenges preconceived notions about how prehistory should look like. And that, in turn, I think is really important because certain scholars have described paleontology as a gateway drug to science. It's one of the first sciences kids get introduced to, because it's something with a relatively low entry bar, because it's a very visual science that works a lot with images. So it is very very quick for a child to find fascinating things in these topics, and that of course can cause them to be more interested in science overall later on. Thank you. And yes, that is something that actually has been tested to a certain degree. There have been studies where they looked at, okay, how do kids fare in school compared to that are interested in dinosaurs compared to those who are not interested in dinosaurs? We are the winners. I don't trust these studies usually that much, but for very selfish reasons, I tend to agree with them in this case. So yeah, I think dinosaurs can do a lot of good for society if we let them. And there is another reason why people like me are coming forward now, introducing these topics to a wider audience, because something else is rising while we speak about this. And that's AI. And I have several issues with AI, image generating AI at least. But the biggest problem I have is that it does not know how to do dinosaurs or other animals, therefore. Like, you would think at first that the T-Rex at the top isn't not that bad. But I can see like 20 different screenshots from Jurassic Park in that were just mushed together to create this. And I talked about earlier how like certain things in these movies are not quite right. And for certain not creative. So what these things do is create extremely boring and for me at least offensive images of prehistoric life. And the problem is this now begins to reach mainstream. On the right here, you see the newest edition of Was ist was, Dinosaurier? I grew up with these books. I really liked them as a kid. And I thought what they showed in there was the truth. Now they have this monstrosity on the cover that you can't really identify. It's some kind of meat-eating dinosaurs. But when you look closely, the eyebrow is clearly from Jurassic Park T-Rex. The snout shape is the Jurassic Park Velociraptor. The teeth begin to melt into the skin and stuff, and there are way too many of them. There's so much wrong with this. I was honestly surprised when I saw this, so surprised that I wrote several pages to the Tesloff publisher and asked, and I ask, guys, with all due respect, what the motherfucking bullshit is this? And they were like, oh, thank you for your comment and blah, blah, blah. I was surprised I got an answer at all. But yeah, but we tested all of this and we decided it's okay, it's okay. And they don't want to change it. I mean, I can understand for this edition to change it now would be too expensive probably, but they could do it in the next one. They bring out a new edition like every few years, but no. Apparently, they are totally on board with this stuff. And yeah, at this point, I end my little thing here. Here you have the finished piece of Alpkarakush, how I imagined it for the press release of the publication. I hope you can take away from this talk that you can do so much more with extinct life than pop culture tells you. I hope some of you get a little bit more skeptical about what is served to you on a blockbuster platter. And if you want to know more, I'm open to your questions. And if you want to find my stuff, these are all social media links and stuff like that. Especially important, the last one, that is the Twitch channel where I stream every weekend and make very transparent how this all works. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. We have time for a few questions.
So usually I hear that paleontology is also used for ecosystem estimation, climate estimation, or any kind of geological dating. And also not to forget about the molecular paleontology. Do you think dinosaurs could help us with that too?
I think dinosaurs are really important, like in promoting paleontology as a rule. They are like our flagship, basically, bringing the science to the masses. That's why also certain non-dinosaur paleontologists really hate dinosaurs, because they take all the stage light away. And I also would have liked to talk about all the other creatures from here, but I know dinosaurs just draw in the crowd, so I had to put it into the title.
Mac 3?
Yes. Okay, thank you very much for this great presentation. I think a lot of people envy you for the work you do. Still, you have so little to work with to generate these images. But how about DNA? Is there so few left of it to determine they have feathers or not? Or is there still some DNA you can determine, well, the image of the dinosaur?
There is, of course, a lot of DNA of birds, so that we can use. And when you combine that with a fossil record, you can create something like a molecular clock that tells you how far this might have gone back. And that gives you different results. One of the hypotheses that is currently tested is that all dinosaurs might have been ancestrally feathered, that even the first dinosaurs already had simple filaments over their body to keep them warm or to show off to mates, stuff like that. DNA does usually not preserve that long, unfortunately. It has, like, similar to radiometric isotopes, a certain half-time, and that goes, like, out of the window after a few couple thousand years. So what is left sometimes, though, are proteins, single proteins, and they can already tell you a little bit. For example, the keratin proteins we find in one particular specimen of T-Rex, once again, is very similar to that of birds, which again shows this connection and the potential presence of feathers.
Ah, great, thank you.
There is a question online.
Yeah, so there's a question about the lifespan and the reproduction rate of dinosaurs, and related to that, the population numbers, how easy it is to estimate all of this. And this person also asked, how likely would it be that a T-Rex would only live for 1 to 2 years?
That is actually extremely likely, because most animals die young. So for a T-Rex to reach its more than 12 meter length, it needs several decades. And a lot can go wrong in that time. And we know from several dinosaur species that they laid a lot of eggs. So they spammed offspring to ensure that at least a few of them made it to adulthood. How old they got is still something that is like in the works. There has been a recent study that showed one specimen of, I think, Apatosaurus being 200 years old. But that might be the exception. Mostly, you will probably reach something like 20 or 30 years for adult individuals.
Well, thank you for the beautiful talk. It was very interesting. I have a question about, you showed so many aspects you touch upon to create the images, and I was wondering, what did you learn? What is your education that you can combine all of this?
As a friend of mine would say, I'm a filthy creative. I studied art at the Art Academy in Münster. All the paleontological stuff is self-learned. Just from very early on, like being fascinated in this stuff, at some point, like beginning to visit conferences, having many friends that are paleontologists, stuff like that, and just reading all the literature.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, one last question. Over the mic.
How do you go to design how the dinosaurs look? Do you just read the papers, or do you meet with the researchers and then they say, oh no, we don't think they had so much muscles, or how does it work?
Usually, yes, I first read, when I'm doing like something like this, like Al-Karakush, a new species, I first like read the paper, immerse myself in the literature, try to piece together already like how the skeleton might have looked like, and then I going back to the scientists and we discuss these first sketches and stuff like that. And it's a constant back and forth basically. And depending on who the commissioner is, I'm getting more or less creative freedom in that. Some paleontologists know very, very well from the start, like, I want to look at like that. And sometimes it's like, oh yeah, here's a fossil, do whatever you want with it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
Yeah.